This season, Handcut Radio is sponsored by Thomas Mason, an historic British textiles brand which is owned and protected by the Albini Group. Dating back to 1796 and founded in the town of Nelson, Lancashire, Thomas Mason has long specialised in luxurious, superfine shirting fabrics, which are known equally for their quality, design flair and textile innovation. From the invention of Zephyr in 1818 to the company's pioneering work in the traceability of cotton today, if you like to have your shirts made, Thomas Mason is the cloth to ask for. Huge thanks to the Thomas Mason team for making this season possible. Now, on with the show. Hello, stylish folk, and welcome to this week's episode of Handcut Radio. I'm your host, Alex Fetkovich. Now, this week is a little bit of a departure from the rest of Season 6, chiefly because in meeting Airmail's deputy editor Michael Haney, I sat down with a journalist I've admired from afar for a very long time. But that does mean this conversation is much more about storytelling than it is menswear. I hold myself entirely responsible for this, but the chance to quiz Michael on his extraordinary career as a reporter and editor, get his take on finding your voice, and hear his thoughts on why the best journalists write what they see rather than what they think, was simply too good to miss. There is loads of wisdom in this conversation that I hope fellow creatives in other fields will find inspiring. And of course, we talk about Michael's remarkable New York Times best-selling book, After Visiting Friends 2. If you haven't read it, you really must. So, without further ado, here is this week's conversation with journalist, author, and Airmail deputy editor, Michael Haney. Michael Haney, I am so delighted to be sat here with you in person in the Airmail offices. This is incredibly exciting. I have admired you and your career and your work from afar for a long time, so thank you very much for taking some time to chat to us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad we've been trying to do this for almost nigh on 2 years now, so yeah. It's just goes to show you that good ideas cannot be stopped.
Oh, I love it. I love it already. I love it. Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. I wanted to start by talking to you about something that I've heard you discuss in interviews before, and actually we've just kind of touched on as we've been walking around outside, which is the pressure as a journalist to be on top of everything that's happening in popular culture all of the time, and then in politics and current affairs and global affairs and all these different things that come into producing a title. Right. I am but a lowly freelancer, and I struggle with this constantly. How do you do it? How do you keep on top of all this stuff in the world and edit?
I think it's, you know, you have to have your trusted sources, you know, and there's a lot of chaff out there, and you got to find the wheat. And I think know the places where you're going to find the right information coming up to you, and also the right opinion, because there's so much opinion now. But I think it's looking at the right, for instance, I love the Guardian UK, you know, and the International Edition as well, which is just great. I found like the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and the FT, you know, they're a team of reporters and writers and thinkers that I trust to bring that material up to you. And then, you know, you've got to know where to find the junk.
Yeah.
You know, the snack food. But I think it's also, you have to learn how to read quickly and find out what is in it and what is speculative and what's not. So and also just, I guess, have the humility as well to know you're never going to know it all. Mm. And that's why I think being part of a good team is helpful.
It's something that someone said to me recently, because I think, as a freelancer, it's very easy to look at every other byline that every other freelancer is getting and panic.
Yeah.
That it wasn't your idea or you didn't get it or whatever. But something that someone told me just a couple of weeks ago that I've been holding on to that was really helpful is when you find the right story, only you can tell the story the way you tell it.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's, you know, there's, I mean, I guess the simple analogy I can make is, you know, when I was at GQ, I used to get this a lot, like someone say like, hey, Daniel Craig has this new movie coming out. It's new. It's the new James Bond. What about a story about him? You know, and you laugh, but it's sort of like, and I have to say to these people, like, I just want to give you an help, a little education. You're like, we know about things like that already. Like, we're way ahead of you. And if you want to become a writer, you have to start to think of the original ideas. And they're not going to be found in the popular press. I mean, the pop culture stuff. I said, you need to start to just give yourself the freedom to think about an idea and like, okay, well, that's an interesting thing, but what is the off-center take on that I might be able to find? And because there's all this stuff that's already being covered, and don't get yourself pulled into, well, shit, like they did that, and they did that, and they did that. How come? You start to work yourself into a froth rather than, you know, start to trust your instincts and to trust your instincts and your interests and follow those. And I think, you know, it might take a little longer to get towards stories that interest you, but you will start to find them because they're going to be what excite you.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's this is I'm gonna change tack now because this is not a therapy session for me, but that's already incredibly useful for me to hear from someone like you, because it is very difficult to resist the panic of I've got to come up with something that wasn't my idea, I couldn't have come up with, you know,
because you could, it's competitive to get someone to publish your stuff, it's competitive to get someone to get their attention, and I mean look. Boy, I've spent my time in London just as a visitor, and the level of competition for ideas and I mean and thinkers and like where the conversation is, it's just as an outsider observing it, it's intimidating, but I think as I said, if you can take a deep breath, and I say this as someone who's spend my sons every day being insecure. If you can sort of think about, you know, what are my ideas? What am I attracted to? And then you're going to find, as they say, your lane, and not be tempted to be pulled into other lanes. Yeah, you've got to look to your left and right and see what everyone's doing. But, you know, all of a sudden, like, wait, why am I trying to pitch food stories? I don't even like food stories, you know, versus I like style. And I'm going to try and learn more about it and find my voice in it. And you know, if you put in the time, you will find your voice. And I think that is also what will distinguish you, is to find your voice, because you'll find so many people like, they're just giving you what someone else just did versus, I want to know Alex's take on it. And I think that's what I really learned a lot at GQ, was to find your voice and one's take on something, and it wasn't just that empty voice, but I'd always say like, find the story within it. Tell me a story. If you can tell me and this is how I would start off assistants, you know, I said, here's the thing. You're going to write captions, and maybe you're going to write 100 words on navy turtleneck sweaters. And I'd say, if you can't make that interesting, you can't make 10,000 words interesting. And they used to think I was making it up, and later I'd give them a quote from Joan Didion, who started at Vogue as a young woman right out of college. And her first thing was writing captions and subheads, right? And it was an exercise that I always tell every writer, which is, this is about compression and concision and making the essence of that story in 100 words, and tell a story in 100 words or 200 words, and find something that no one's ever said about that houndstooth coat and make it interesting. So because that is like writing a pop single if you're the Beatles, right? You know, like, can you do it and make it, huh, that was fun. And so, and catch an editor's eye and like, well, they can do 200, maybe they can do 500, and maybe they can do 2,000. And you build yourself up from there rather than just trying to, you know, make more fluff that the world doesn't need.
Yeah. I mean, that's already, I feel like I've had my inspirational pep talk today. So thank you.
My pleasure.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about your story. You've mentioned GQ. We're obviously sat here at Airmail. For those listeners who might not be so familiar with your work right. and your career, could you give me a quick whiz through? I know that there's quite a lot to whiz through.
No, I love the Britishism. Quick whiz through.
I know you started at Spy, which right. is this sort of mythic, sort of satirical title that right. existed for how many years, roughly? I can't remember now.
Roughly about 11 years in various forms, but it was started by Graydon Carter and Kurt Anderson in the mid-80s. And it was kind of there. They were inspired by Private Eye, but they wanted to do a New York satirical magazine. It was a monthly, and it was hugely influential. It's you still see its influence if you really want to get it. There's a book that was written about it, called The Spy Years, and you can see. We joke about that. The people who came up from there, it's like being in the Soviet Union and you just go on after that because the influence was everywhere but I got a lucky break although I always say my therapist would say no break is lucky, you took the chance and you earned it. But I came to New York, I was reading Spy, I was living in Chicago, and they had an ad in the back for interns, and so I applied, and they said, come out for an interview. So I came out for an interview, and I got the internship. It was a six-month internship, and it paid $50 a week. And I had a little bit of money saved up, but I had an uncle living up in Connecticut, and I lived with him. And I was about 6 weeks into the interview, and it was at the Christmas party, and everyone was kind of in their cups, as one might say. And Graydon called me over and he said, come over here. I said, what? And he said, I've been watching you and I thought I'd done something really bad. So I panicked and I said, what? And he said, I think you've got talent. And I was so nervous, I walked away. He said, I'm not finished. Come back. So I came back. He said, no, I think you really got talent. I said, thank you. And he said, effective immediately, I'm going to make you a staff writer. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And so a couple of my friends, or you might say mates, there was a lull between, this is the Christmas party that started in the office, then there was going to be a Christmas party in a restaurant. And there was a lull for about 2 hours where everyone's going to go home and change. My two other young guys who were with me took me out for drinks. And then we went to the Christmas party. Christmas party lasted until 2 a.m. And it was just this legendary party. It actually shows up in the book. And I woke up the next morning convinced either I dreamt it or he was not going to remember he gave me a job. So I didn't bother to tell my mother or anything. I went, well, that was nice. That'll be a fun little story for the memoir. And then I went to work the next morning. It was so long ago, children who are not of age, there was once a thing called a mimeograph machine. And pre-email, office email. But sure enough, that morning, about 9:30, one of the assistants distributed mimeograph copies of We're Pleased to Announce Michael Laney's been promoted. And so that was, and I was promoted to the lordly sum of $10,500 salary. But it was the beginning of kind of my foot in the door, and Kurt and Graydon both very kindly mentored me up because I came to New York thinking I'd worked for a couple of years in Chicago, but thinking I knew what it was to write for a magazine. And I got here and realized these people are like, I just decided my strategy was to keep my mouth shut, my eyes open, and just do whatever they told me to do. And it was this fantastic kind of finishing school for learning how to write and edit.
So, incredible.
Yeah.
And how long were you at Spy?
At Spy for about 2 years, and then the recession came and a bunch of us were sacked. And, you know, it was the beginning of what I learned to be the kind of cycle of... a bunch of us were let go, and then I tried to freelance very unsuccessfully through that, and then I caught on doing some freelance, and I got a job at Details magazine, which was a magazine that Condé Nast started in the mid 90s as a young version of GQ. It was like, this is when they were like trying to capture, you know, the original Gen Xers, and you know, when Slackers and all that thing was happening. And so I caught on there as a assistant editor, senior editor, and I was there for about 3 years, and then I got hired at GQ in 1999.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to say, from my reading, is it something like 17 years at GQ, something like that?
Yeah, 17, 18 years at GQ, 20 years total at Condé, because that went from Details over to GQ, but yeah, about 18 years.
Incredible. Yeah. So you had a couple of years kind of training in a magazine like Spy, which is kind of a satire, a political kind of satire title.
Right.
What was it like then sort of transitioning to sort of men's lifestyle titles? Was it quite an easy leap? Or
yeah, I mean, because Spy was, you know, you have to remember Curtin Grain came out of Time magazine. So everything, even though it was satire, everything was reported and fact-checked, and we didn't print anything that was not true.
Mm.
So people think, like, you're making that up. That cannot be true that so-and-so actually, you know, said that at a party, or so-and-so actually did that embarrassing thing. Like, no, it's fact-checked. It's with we went through the lawyers and the whole thing. So you learned to write and report really well and do crazy reporting. And you know, we used to do this thing called the Iron Man Party Challenge, and we would follow three New York guys around, Jay McInerney and Anthony Hayden Guest what's his name, who wrote Less Than Zero, Bret Easton Ellis, and on like over a course of two nights. And you know, I would be assigned to one guy, my friend John Brody, you know, David Cameron, and we would just tail them. They didn't even know we were tailing them, but like okay, 11:35, they walked into Nell's, ordered a martini, smoked two packs of cigarettes, and you just would observe them. Like that was like that was the Iron Man challenge to see who could party the hardest among these three guys, and like it was participatory reporting, but you learn to, you know, as I would tell junior people later, like, you don't even know how to like how to go out and report and make yourself, you know, if you're not going to about get a punch in the face, you're not risking something. You know, you've got to get out and really, and I say, you know, that is, for instance, too many people now, all they do is like, they just email someone and that's the reporting. I said, no, go knock on their door, go see if you can get a cup of coffee with them. That's how you're going to get the real story and get the presence of who they are. So, but transitioning over to your point about men's lifestyle, you know, it's ending up at GQ. It's a version of, remember the old story about the old joke about I get Playboy for the articles. Like it was a version because all the time these young guys would come to me when I was at GQ, like, oh my God, I want to work at GQ. I love clothes. How do I get a job like this? And I said, like, I always cared about fashion and style, but I ended up at GQ because the boss at the time, Art Cooper, had seen a bunch of stories I'd edited and had heard great things about me and offered me a job to be an editor there and a writer. So I got hired for the articles. And then my sort of transition into overseeing a lot of the style coverage and doing all that was when Art Cooper died and left and Jim Nelson became the editor-in-chief, you know, and he made me the deputy editor. You know, one of the things we really wanted to change, and this was, you know, in 2003, and we realized there's a whole new generation of men coming into the world, and we felt that, you know, style was not something you sort of segmented into the back of the magazine or one, or we wanted to bring that throughout this and make that style not just how you dress, but how you live, how you furnish your flat or your apartment, and what you, where you eat, and how you travel. Like, it was, style was becoming a way that permeated a lot of things. So we wanted to, you know, I wanted to, but bring that rigor of reporting and story writing and that standard of excellence to all things, as I was saying a minute ago, just like, even if it's a 200 word thing about like why these chukka boots, why you love them, tell me a story that makes it interesting, you know, give me some enthusiasm rather than just write bad catalog copy. So it was bringing that rigor that you learned in that journalistic standard to that piece of it.
Mm. So what, if this is an answerable question, what makes a story interesting to you then? You know, are there certain things that you apply to looking at men's style or looking to current affairs or looking at sort of a political story? You know, how do you think about this is interesting or this isn't?
Well, I think, I guess, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different kinds of stories you said there, but I think it's, I always look for, nothing makes a story more concrete to me than details. And I find a lot of writers don't have details. And I think details are what makes something pop off the page. You know, if you, even the way someone can describe something in detail, a story and a memory, and that gives it voice, that gives it, it helps it come alive in the mind. You'll realize how many things, how many writers give you something and they never conjure an image in your mind. And I think good writing does that. And, or, and even if it's that 500 word deep caption, like, huh, I just, that was, you know, I always compare it to, look, if you had to sit across in a table in a bar right now from a friend and tell them why you love this thing, how do you do it? You know, make it interesting, and make it, and it's gotta have that voice and vibrancy and those details, you know, rely on details. Tell me what you're seeing. So I'm kind of giving you pieces of it there, but it's different stories have different components. But I think it's, you know, a lot of writers, I think they forget to tell you just what they saw. And I say, slow down, tell me what you saw, what were the details, and start to bring alive that rather than telling me what you think. And if people want to get ahead of themselves, and I think this has happened too much because of social media, people think, well, my opinion. And your opinion is one thing, but what authority do you have? But if you lean into the details and the heritage and the experience and what it was like, then it starts to become something that I can understand and want to participate in.
I don't think anyone has ever said to me before, sort of write about what you saw as opposed to what you think. That's really fascinating to me.
Well, it's great advice I got early on. It just is, you know, people like, whether it's a travel piece or a restaurant piece, or, you know, it's, you have to like that. Those are the, when you break it down, like the who, what, where, when, why, and how, but like, what did I see? How did it make, you know, what was it? And, you know, I used to say this to people when they had to write, when my friend Adam Rappaport and I used to go over to the men's shows for GQ, and, you know, Adam was the one who said it once, and he wrote sports for the college newspaper, and he said, I love writing these because it's just like writing a sports write-up. Like, it's just like, what did you see? And it's true. But you couldn't just say like, well, here's the game. You have to say like, and then this happened and this happened. But it's, if you start with that, those, what did I see? That's the skeleton of it. And then you can start to, what did you think?
Yeah.
Right? But many people, and I don't know, you know, this might be a difference, but I find that a lot of the British journalism is very much opinion driven, and I think that that's not a criticism. It's just something that I've noticed. But I think there's people who clearly have authority, so they have that. But then I see some people, like, you can just see them padding it out. Well, I woke up this morning, I had coffee, and while I was having coffee, I said to my wife, you know, gee, the prime minister certainly isn't a jam today, isn't he? Like, and it just is.
Yeah.
I don't get that, but, yeah, you know, it, bring me something that's...
There's a risk of being self-indulgent, isn't there, I think.
That would be the phrase.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Because there's no urgency to it, right? And yeah. I always say, you know, you live in a world where people are flicking, and, like, you have less than a split second to grab their attention now before they're like, eh, I'm bored.
Mm.
And so that pressure to make that... those first two sentences, something, that's new, that's interesting. Hold on, what's he got here?
Yeah, yeah, we're in here. There's a reason to read this. It's not a personal reflection on something.
Yeah.
I can find them out somewhere else. Okay, thank you. Again,
how's our therapy session?
Thank you. super, super insightful for me. Thank you. I wanted to. We've touched on the fact that you were at GQ for 17 years. That's a huge amount of time. I presume you saw a huge amount of change in that time.
Enormous.
Let's get into that.
Sure. How? When I started, there was basically no internet.
Yeah.
I mean, there was, but it was still, you know, print was king. And there was, you know, I mean, there would be issues with 300 pages, 400 pages in them. And, We didn't even have budgets. You just worked. You didn't know how much money you were spending, and so it was an extraordinary opportunity. It was the high water period of American magazines, and I still feel so fortunate to have participated in it. But you know, I remember moments now when I look back, when, like, because I also, when I was at GQ, then I oversaw the creation of GQ.com, and which was fine. We were moving into digital, but I remember the real moment was when the smartphone came in, and you just saw all the editors in the office spending time on their smartphones now, and I'm like, well, if these guys can't be bothered sometimes, like, and if their attention is going there, you know, where's everyone else's? And I think the smartphone came in just around the same time as the financial crash or the of 2008. So that was the kind of double whammy that really started that 10-year slide of cut. But it was, look, when it was from about 1999 to 2009, 2010, it was fantastic, because the resources at Condé Nast to do great journalism and great photography and great magazines, whether it was GQ or Vogue or The New Yorker or Vanity Fair, it was, you know, Cy Newhouse's dedication and commitment to that was unparalleled. So it was remarkable, you know. I always say we got the last bite of the apple.
Yeah. Proudest moment? Is there anything that particularly stands out from you from that time, or a particular story or issue? Or
I think, you know, I have moments that I was like, I think there are stories of my own that I remember. I mean, a couple of moments, just, you know, interviewing people like Clint Eastwood and Keith Richards and Dustin Hoffman and some of these, like, 2-3-4 day conversations I get to have with people, and learning to really bring my interviewing skills and to start to craft that memoir kind of voice for things. So I think, you know, I think as a team, you know, we won a number of general excellence awards, and, you know, the number of, and the range of writers. We published from James Elroy to George Saunders to Liz Gilbert to, you know, just because it was, you could get anyone to write for you, and we did. And I think the stories that Jim committed to, and but then the visual excellence that we had, it was a blast. We worked hard, but it was a blast.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I just wish I could have experienced some of that. You know, I hear all these sort of legendary stories, and
well, I think, you know, I have faith that people like you guys, it's everything I see. I mean, vinyl is back, and you know, and you know, film photography is coming back. I think the tactile, there's a hunger for tactile, and I think there's not going to be, you know, those Condé Nast budgets of yore, but I think the, you know, more people are buying more books now than digital books all of a sudden. I think people want to come in contact with it. I think it's just looking for the right people to create the right magazines, and they'll be smaller, but they'll be more valuable and valued. And I think that's the opportunity for you guys.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's something we've talked to a lot of journalists about over the course of this podcast is, you know, you can kind of see it happening now. And one of the questions I've got written down for you here is, do you think the era of general interest, general lifestyle magazines is drawing to a close?
Yeah.
It sort of sounds like it is in a big kind of corporate sense. But what we are seeing and starting to see is loads of what I call sort of cult magazines, like 10,000, 15,000 copies. Maybe it's a really beautiful biannual, maybe it's a bi-monthly, but that are super focused on a passion or a singular point of view. Those magazines seem to be developing huge followings and kind of growing healthily, and that excites me. I mean, my favorite magazine at the moment still, which I think is now on issue 8, 9, is L'Etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really speaks to me.
Yeah.
I feel like it captures, I love the team there. I feel like it captures how I dress. It's digestible. It's kind of characterful. It's poppy. It makes you want to just flick through it and pick up and come back. And I keep, you know, like I sort of, I went back to my back issues of it the week before coming over here because I was thinking about, right, I'm going around to New York. I'm going to New York for a week. What do I pack? Can I make that pair of trousers work with this jumper because I've only got a small case? You know, that magazines like that are coming into their own.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't see a world in which the big corporate publishing houses can continue to persist like this.
And I think that's okay, because maybe you don't want the big corporate houses doing it. It's kind of in a way like, you know, the big Hollywood studios, all they know how to make now are Marvel action movies, right? And the A24 studios and, you know, the smaller ones are making the movies that people care about, right? And I think it's, and I say this as someone who's like always looking to the past for inspiration, I would say, find the right inspiration in it, but don't get sort of like enslaved by it. And instead, trust your own. I think that magazine you mentioned, like, they're just going way deep on the things that they care about. And it's your reaction to it is exactly as it should be. Because like, what are you reacting to? It's like, they're so passionate. They care about it. And like, and it's just like being in the hands of someone like, you've got to see this, and they're making this artifact, and it's beautiful, and it's like it's somewhere between a book and a magazine, but it's an artwork, and I don't know what it is, but God, I can't stop like looking at it. It just is, and reading it like this, and so I would find the lessons in that, and I think there's, to me, that's this kind of mini renaissance that's there, and that, you know, it's quality over quantity then, right? It's, you know, do you want the gigantic public? Because, and it, you know, in a way it's what airmail is like. Creighton didn't want to go back to having to sell, print a million copies a month. You like, you know, because, you know, Condé Nast had gone from this business model, which was always, you know, quality over quantity, and then it flipped over, it went upside down, and now all of a sudden we are chasing numbers. And, you know, once you start chasing numbers, it's very hard, like, because you've got to, but if you get, like, the right advertising supporter, like one or two people believe in you, modest budget, you can make something that's impressive and that doesn't where you don't sacrifice your vision. And then, you know what, then after maybe a year or two, someone's like, hey, I notice what you're doing. Like, I'd like to, fund you for X amount. Like, just keep doing what you're doing, right? Because if you try and make what you think is going to be popular and big,
you're dead in the water.
It's the whole thing. It's like, fail doing what you want to do, because that's probably what someone's going to notice. But if you fail doing what, imitating what, you'd be like, you're going to, it's not going to be exciting to you. It's not going to be fun. And you're not going to discover something in the world's not going to discover you.
Mm. Well, thank you. Let's come on to Airmail. What is it like working on a digital-only weekly? Did you ever think that you would work on a title like this?
No, and I always thought I'd never work at a weekly, because I always was too scared to do it, because it was just like, I don't have the metabolism for that. I love the monthly. But even though when I look back at it, like, GQ was a monthly that closed like a weekly, so I thought, like, you know, I think what's great about a weekly from a journalism point of view is, like, you sort of, you know what you've got to do every day. Like, Monday we do this, Tuesday we do this, like, by Thursday we're closing, Friday, you know, so you can't, but on the other hand, you certainly have to learn to juggle a lot and to be more versatile. But I never thought I'd do it.
So how did it come about? Did you join for launch? Is that correct?
I came about for launch. I'd been at Esquire.
Yes.
After I left GQ, into Esquire for 3 years, and then I, the tide went out there. So I had run into Graydon, and he told me what he was up to, and I said, and he said, you know, maybe you could help come over and get us through launch. And so, you know, because you've got digital experience, and, you know, you got the, and it'd be great. And I said, I'd be thrilled. I'd be honored. So came here for what I, again, sort of almost like the spy internship. I thought it was going to be, you know, 3-4 months, and going on 3 years now, because it's been a thrill. So
awesome. And what I'm curious to sort of know what a week looks like then, when you know you've got to get this thing into people's inboxes on a Saturday morning,
right?
And all the content has to be uploaded and ready,
right?
Can you just talk me through what a week looks like?
Monday, you're kind of like, you get the, you know, the lineup comes around Monday, Sunday night, maybe Monday morning. You know the stories you've got, they're put in your queue. You've got to edit them, put heads, decks on them, you know, pull quotes, all the things, that, so they can quickly get into the copy flow and the fact checking. And then it's like Tuesday, I'm writing the email blast and the cover lines, and probably Wednesday. And then, you know, you're dealing with copy queries and no revisions coming through. Wednesday, I'm recording the podcast, and then maybe Thursday doing a guest of the podcast and still doing a piece. You're trying to then look at pieces coming ahead for next week that you've got to get edited, because then there's always the churn of them, so you've got to be like 2-3 weeks ahead of what stories you've assigned and got coming in, turning in drafts and stuff. So and then Friday you're closing,
and then I guess invariably, you know, you're trying to work 2-3 weeks ahead or however many weeks ahead, but then something happens, there's a scandal or there's a headline in the news media and something drops out,
exactly,
and you panic and you have to get it.
No, so it's like, you know, today's Monday, but I'm telling you, like, Tuesday, Wednesday, even like Thursday, someone like, oh, guess what? Andre Leon Talley died. Like, we should, like, we got to do this, this, and this. And so, you know, pieces move out, and then you got to adjust. And but
how do you cope with that? Do you just sort of reach a point where you're just like, I'm zen, what will be, what's the sort of mental process like? Because I just think it sounds relentless.
You know, I take a Klonopin if I have to. no, I you sort of just, you tell yourself, like, the issue always comes out. You know, it happens, and you know, you learn to rely on colleagues. Can you take a look at this? Tell me if I'm missing something. But you just have to learn to roll with it. and you know, like, it's not about your piece being bad. It's going to bump to the next week. And, like, you know, I think it's just, everything's happening for a reason. I've just got to, like, learn to just, you know, not fall too far behind right now. So,
are there any airmail pieces that you've published or written or edited that you've been particularly sort of pleased with over the past sort of few years? Is there anything that you feel really sums up what airmail stands for?
We did a really great piece about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. It was about this journalist named Stephen Glass, who back in the early 2000s, late 90s, was probably the most prolific plagiarist in American journalism. He worked the New Republic for about 5 years, and he turned out he was either plagiarizing or making up large swathes of his pieces. And they actually made a movie out of it called Shattered Glass. And it's a piece where this writer went back and found him and found out what he's been doing for the last 10 years and how he'd rebuilt his life and how it's a heartbreaking piece, because this guy who, after he had lied to so many people and destroyed his career, said that he would never lie again. And he took that vow. He said, never gonna lie again. And he met this woman, fell in love with her, they got married. And she was in her 40s, they're both in her 40s. She was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. And he said, well, it's okay, we're gonna get through it together. And she said, no, we're not gonna tell anyone. So she, in that moment, makes him have to start lying to people, the one thing he doesn't want to do, including friends and family. And it tears him up so much he can't even, like, but he loves her, so he's going to do it. And after about a year, there's a friend of theirs says, what is wrong with your wife? And why? And so he breaks down crying, sobbing, like, and he says, I've been lying to you. And but the whole, this group of friends rallies around them, and it's a story of, like, forgiveness and rebuilding your life. And I think it's just a beautiful story and very powerful. It's available online. But I think that's a good example of, like, those, you know, when people say, gee, I miss the old Vanity Fair. It was this kind of stories that, you know, Graydon still does, and just ported them over to airmail here.
Yeah. Now that sounds, I don't remember seeing that, I have to confess, but it sounds incredible. I'll go back
incredible.
And find it.
Yeah, riveting.
I do very much enjoy, and this is possibly with the sort of a British lens on it, I really enjoy Joe Bullmore's pieces.
Yes.
I know Joe, and I'm very fond of him, and they're absolutely sizzling. I really enjoy those.
Yeah, because he's always got, like, bad behavior among the Brits.
Indeed, yeah. It's just sort of
the moneyed titled, you know, and then Stu Heritage.
Yes.
Yeah, he's got the other end of that spectrum covered as well.
Yeah, so, no, yeah. I love it. I love that sort of chipping away of the establishment slowly in his bad behavior.
I just want Rachel Johnson to write what happens when Bojo goes down. So that's all, you know.
Yeah, let us see. Let us see when that day comes. I'm going to ask quickly, but we've talked about this a little bit, but just to see sort of to sum things up, what do you think the future of sort of magazine and media making looks like today? Because one thing we haven't touched on actually is social media and where the impact of social sits in all this.
Yeah.
Let's break that down a little bit. Social media, love it, hate it. Do you think it's a force for good? Do you think it's sort of watered down the reporting of stories and storytelling? What's your kind of take on that?
I think, first of all, that social media, specifically Twitter, has convinced a lot of people that just because they can put their thoughts out into the world, that they're a writer. And I don't mean that snobbly. I mean it more as, like, that just, you know, farting out opinions does not make you a writer. And it sort of, like, gave everyone access to the means of production, quote unquote. And, you know, then they got responses and they think, oh, people... And I think that's been a negative. I think that, you know, social media and Facebook, it's been, as we're seeing now with the Facebook papers and the GUI, like they're perhaps collusion to destroy magazines and then the advertising market that funded that was not good. So there's a strike against social media. And I think social media, it makes them feel more quote unquote connected, but it makes them, a lot of them feel pretty lonely. And I think what's happened is it's just chipped away at community. And I was telling this to someone the other night, who is not of my generation, but you know, I said, you know, the great thing about a Saturday night used to be, which was like, you know, like I was sitting there home alone and I called someone and I couldn't get a hold of anyone. And then wander down to the corner bistro and place on my block. I go and sit at the bar and I'd end up talking to someone and, or a couple of people. I'd watch a game and like, you know, I read the paper and bring in a book and end up like, but they knew me and people, I'd run into strangers or something, but it forced one to put yourself in a place and see what would happen with people who you weren't going to interact. But it was a small community. And these communities, I think, of interaction and that was life before algorithms told you where to go. And it was just, I think that, but that the impact it's had on community. And I use that word not ironically. I think it's communities being lost, and you know, these online communities they're not a substitute for, I think, even just doing what we're doing here, just sitting here and talking, you know.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. I also worry and often think that it runs the risk of making a lot of us lazy in our thinking as well.
Right.
And that's the thing that really bothers me. Is that it just becomes, I mean, you've sort of pointed out already, haven't you? It becomes so easy to sort of disseminate an opinion without really putting any nuance behind it, or any kind of sense of tolerance, or any sense that there might be an alternative point of thinking. Yeah. I struggle with that a lot, and I worry that then runs the risk of feeding into newsrooms or reporting or the way that the media try, because as soon as you start thinking about a story for the way it's going to perform on social media, that for me is another real danger for mainstream kind of news and all lifestyle media, really.
Well, and that brings it right sort of almost full circle to where we started, which was, you're not pursuing the stories that you think are going to be interesting and important. You're pursuing them. You know, you're 26 years old. You're sitting in the newsroom and like, I got to get on the tote board up there. And I know that this story on, if I take X plus Y, I could make, you know, this Frankenstein monster and everyone will love that on social media. And yet, you know,
it's grim. That's a grim prospect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talking of all this talk about storytelling, then we've talked a lot about making magazines. The last thing I kind of wanted to touch on today is your book.
Yes.
Which I'm sure everyone who interviews whoever says they absolutely loved and is brilliant.
Well, that's the only thing they're allowed to say. We all know that you have to sign a piece of paper that I will only interview if you say it that way.
Well,
just confessing this to all the listeners.
You know, it is, at the risk of sort of saying something that has been said a million times before, it is a really, really moving, powerful read. And what I loved about it, obviously me sat here and us talking about the things that we talk about, is it feels like a piece of investigative reporting that you sort of took it upon yourself to do.
Right.
And this search for kind of truth and for answers.
Right.
I just wanted to kind of understand a bit more of the thought process that went into you deciding to do that and then writing the book. You know, how did you approach?
Sure. I think it's a good question, and I think my answer, I hope, would be a bit of inspiration for anyone out there who's wanting to be a writer and feels, or is even a writer now, but feels like, I'm a little tentative about my voice or what I should be doing and how I should be. I'll put it this way. I was at GQ, and The first 6 or 7 years I was at GQ, I didn't write a thing. Because, as I said, there were all these writers of immense talent, and even a lot of the editors on staff were such, and I was like, I was just psyched out. I just couldn't, I was like, I'm not going to write, I'm just going to edit. That's all I'm going to do. And I had a friend who, like me, had lost his father when he was a boy. And we used to get together for drinks, and when we always joke, it was our club of two, called the Dead Dads Club. Because we just, you know, and we would inevitably like start to tell stories about growing up without a father. And I used to tell him about this mystery about my father dying. And he said to me at the end of one night, he said, listen, you got to write this. I said, no, no, no. He said, next time we meet, just bring me some pages. And it was, you know, I walked home that night and I thought, well, God damn it. You know, like, yeah, what am I doing? You know, and he kind of called my bluff / gave me permission. And I think sometimes you just need someone who's going to give you permission, or you need someone to say, like, do this. And so I went on that night and I just write it. And there were some of the lines made it into the book, some didn't, but it was the beginning of the process of just like, and yet I knew the voice I wanted to do in there. And it was very unlike a voice I'd seen in, that was happening in GQ. And I was very, you know, tentative about that at the beginning. But it was also a voice that I believed was a way to tell a story. And what's sort of funny is when the book came out, to almost a person, each of the writers I'd edited would be like, where did you, like, that voice is unbelievable. Like, how did you discover your voice? And I just said, you idiot. Like, you know, like, not that bad. I said, I've been trying to get you to, like, think this way for a long time. But, I mean, obviously you can't make someone write the way you want. But I just, it was the music I was hearing that I kept telling myself, no one wants to hear music this way. But I just said, you know what? This was the theme of the day. It's like, I'm going to do it the way I hear it, the way I see it. And either people are going to like it or not, but I can only do it the way I hear the voice and the way I want it to be. So that's really, you know, how it came to be.
And I guess in doing it that way, it just sort of, did it feel quite natural? Was it easy to write once you'd started sort of digging into it? Or was it emotionally challenging or cathartic?
It was, the difficult part was, you know, I was reporting it as I was writing it. So I had to find out, it took me almost 10 years to write it, because just the reporting to find out what had happened took me about 6 years, because the various dead ends I ran into, and then polishing and revising it. And, you know, again, just maybe in a way to inspire people, is I wrote that without an advance. I just wrote it. It's been 8-9 years writing it. And I was saying to my wife, but my girlfriend at the time, and said, what happens if I finish this and no one buys it, no one wants it? And she said, well, you'll have done it for yourself. And it sounds like something out of a movie, but she was right. I mean, like, I would have been proud of it, and I would have somehow figured out a way to even get it out there in the world. But it was, I realized I didn't want to do a proposal and get an advance, because I didn't want to be beholden to anyone. I just wanted the freedom to do it at my pace, in my way. And even when I once tried to write in advance, I'm like, write a proposal, I'm like, I don't even know how to write like this. Ugh. You know, so I just put it aside. As I say, I hope it just inspires anyone to, whether it's writing a book or a magazine piece, or, you know, trust, give yourself that one challenge that, you know, there's no quote unquote market for it right now, but it's going to be an exercise that probably is going to stretch you to professionally, talent-wise, emotionally. So, you know, just give you, I'm going to try and write this thing now and see where it goes. And not everyone can afford 8 years to work on a book. I was doing it while I had a job, but, you know, there might be like, I'm going to give myself a challenge, like do a reported piece and see if I can, about this thing I'm interested in. without a commission. You know, because maybe it's like you've got to do the one thing that no one's going to commission, because people, don't forget, like, those editors are in the same echo chamber that the writers are. They're just trying to find things, but all of a sudden, like, that one new thing that they hadn't thought about, like, hey, this is, wow, someone just got my attention with something because it's new and it's covering something I haven't seen before. So,
yeah. And lo and behold, New York Times bestseller.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you.
Wonderful. I have one more question about the book, and then just one more question for you, I promise. And then sure. I shall let you have your evening. I wanted to ask, because presumably publishing the book and finding those answers was an extremely cathartic experience. How did your family react to the book? You know, was it a nerve-wracking experience, sort of putting it out in the world?
It's a very good question, and in fact, I sort of like, you know, the person I thought was going to, I was so worried about hurting or destroying our relationship with my mother. And in fact, it brought us, the book brought us closer, and it opened up a new chapter in our relationship where we've become much closer because of the book, because the answers I found and that I shared with her about my father, her husband, and how he died and the circumstances. And as she said to me some weeks later after I showed her the book, she said, she called me crying after she'd read it. And I thought, oh my God, I've destroyed this. And I said, why are you crying? She said, because it gave me answers that I realized I needed. And because I had had questions that for 40 years I'd kept pushed down, but they came up now, and they needed to come up, and now I can see them. And, you know, so it opened up this new conversation with us, and especially with my brother as well. So very fortunate that it became this, you know, people always say, did the book give you closure? And I say, no. You don't want closure, you want new openings, and that's really what it gave me.
Well, yeah. Wonderful. I mean, that's such a sort of a heartwarming thing to hear. Yeah. And after that, all those years of crafting this and working through self-doubt and going, oh my God, why, you know, this is, and going down the rabbit hole, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, and I say that, like, I'm well aware that there are many people who will be listening, it's like, who's your free say? And that's not, it's, I say it is, just stick with that. If you've got something you really believe in, whether it's a book or, you know, a photo book you want to do, or a written book or a piece of art or a magazine idea, stick with it, because if not now, when? If not you, who? And time is running out. And like, and you know what? Like, there's no such thing as failure. Like, it might be something that you get 100 pages into it. Ah, okay, it's not going to work out, but there's going to be something in it to be value. And I would say that, like, there are lines in that book that I used from poems I wrote when I was in college, because I was like, wait a minute, I've got a poem. I always want to, that's, and you know, like, keep the material is always, the good material is always going to live, and it's always going to find a way into the work you want to do.
Last one for you then. Yes, on a totally different note, what's coming next for Airmail, and what's coming next for you? Is there anything on the horizon that's interesting or exciting?
I think Airmail, you know, we're growing and it's expanding. So I think more stories, and I hope more podcasts coming down the road, and you know, looking to do, you've just got a big new round of investment. So I think Graydon's got big ambitions, and you know, that's all will be revealed in the next few months, I hope.
Wow, exciting. Yeah. Okay. And any projects of your own? Or
I'm working on a second book. It's a sort of sequel to the memoir, maybe answering some of your questions there, and also currently working on the screenplay of the book as well. So
The screenplay of the book.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. So I've got a very nice, very successful screenwriter in Hollywood, fell in love with a book, called me up and said, let's write it together. So we've been, that's been our lockdown project. So knock on wood, we'll get to, we're get to a conclusion of it this year.
Wow. Oh, well, I cannot wait to see that take shape. Yes.
And then we'll do another one of these.
That would be glorious. Yes. That would be absolutely dreamy. Michael, thank you so, so much for taking some time out.
My pleasure for being here. And to everyone listening, it's you can always get me and Michael Haney at Gmail if you have any other questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There you have it, folks. That's this week's interview done and dusted. If you enjoyed it, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Positive reviews propel us up the podcast charts and help other people to discover Handcut Radio. Note also that this podcast is produced by Birch, a London-based creative agency that has specialised in the fields of lifestyle and luxury since 2009. Our sound editor and theme music composer is Mr. Joe Boyd. You can hear more from him on social media and SoundCloud at This Is Joe Boyd. That's all from us. Have a wonderful week to come, and we'll see you back here before too long.